And well, it's already been a good day here, hasn't it? I love hearing some of those older hymns and put to a fresh tune and just presented well. So I appreciate you guys serving us this morning. These musicians, they do a fabulous job. And, it actually takes a little bit more than just showing up at 10 o'clock on a Sunday. So you guys are aware of that. So we do appreciate all our musicians that serve us and those guys that make it all happen in the back. And, sound guys really have my sympathy because nobody looks at them unless something goes wrong. You know, everything's flawless. And then it's just like, what'd you do? You know, nobody ever said anything when everything is right. They're just invisible and they serve us so well. And it's great to be here. I'm so glad to be settling back into John this morning. And really the cumulative effect of a gospel study verse by verse is really, really powerful when you kind of get the whole picture in your mind. Something that Adam said earlier that I really appreciated. He said, you know, speaking particularly to our guests that are maybe here or maybe you're new, just kind of checking this thing out, seeing what we're all about. And he said, I hope that we're easy to figure out. And I do hope that we are easy to figure out. We're pretty simple in what we do. We do old things. We gather together. We look at an old book that we believe is the inspired word of God, the Bible. We base everything off of that. We gather together to worship God. We sing songs in worship to God. And we try to one another well within the body and try to have good relationships. And then we try to live lives and do things to reach out and to tell others about the gospel. And that's kind of who we are. You're not going to find much else. But we believe that's the church. That's what God has ordained to do his work. And so that's who we are. That's what we do. And if you're new with us, well, we are so glad. And we would love to talk to you more about who we are, what we do, and how we think. John chapter 6 this morning. John chapter 6. And we come to a story in the Bible this morning that's a pretty well-known story where Jesus feeds the 5,000 people. It's well-known, and it's well-known for good reason. It's a pretty astonishing feat that Jesus pulled off, so it's well-known, obviously, for that. There's another reason it's probably pretty well-known. This is actually the only miracle that's recorded in all four gospel accounts. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all contain some sort of telling of Jesus feeding the 5,000. That signals something for us, right? This is a significant event, and it happens at a significant time, and we're going to get to take that apart just a little bit. If you're a note taker and just curious, Matthew 14, Mark 6, Luke 9. That's where you can read the other accounts for that. Matthew 14, Mark 6, Luke 9. If you're not into that, welcome back. This is a well-known story, and it happens at a strategic time, and it happens at the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus is in the middle of this northern part of his ministry, and the Gospel of John really doesn't tell us a lot about Jesus ministering in this particular area, but this is one place where he does dive into that, and some of the other Gospel accounts give a lot more detail about Jesus' Galilean ministry, particularly like Mark and Luke give us a lot of information about that you can cross-reference. And I've told you guys before, I think what John is really doing is he's providing sort of the color commentary on what's going on. So he's not giving us the play-by-play necessarily, but he's the guy that sits over in the booth that, you know, says something insightful every now and then, or at least tries. That's John. He's giving us insight, and I think John is assuming that you are familiar a little bit with the material, with what Jesus actually did, and so now he's just giving you some insight, and he had a different purpose in writing. He writes later, and he's not necessarily trying to establish the timeline of Jesus' ministry. That's already been done, but he's just giving insight into the Messiah and why you should believe in Jesus the Messiah. That's the ministry of John. And so we come to this story, and we've just come off the heels of this story where Jesus heals the man back in Jerusalem, back to the south. He heals this man, and he gets himself in all kinds of trouble after that with the Pharisees, because they don't like the fact that he did this on the Sabbath, and he caused this guy to violate one of their rules. And so he gets into it with the Pharisees in the south, and then he calls them out and says, "You guys don't know what you think you know," in essence. And the curtain kind of drops there, and we're left there, and we'll be reintroduced later to this tension that was going on in Jerusalem with Jesus. But we transition, and the contrast couldn't be any more stark. So he leaves Jerusalem. John leaves us there, and everybody's mad at Jesus. And we come to the north, to Galilee, and there's thousands of people following Jesus. So the contrast is set up, and I believe it's intentional by the gospel writer John, and he's setting this up and wants to show us something. Well, by the end of this story, Jesus has got everybody mad again. So it doesn't last long. And you'll see this tension that Jesus just continues to create everywhere he goes. And the tension is because of unbelief, ultimately. That's what the problem is. And John is very detailed to spell that out for us. I want to just mention a few really bad ideas that have come about this miracle and story throughout church history. And you may have heard some of these as you were growing up in church, depending on kind of what your background and the history of that church. One writer, and this is actually not, it was actually known in some circles that this is how you interpreted this story. One person said, well, Jesus didn't actually feed all those people. Here's really what happened. This is a lesson about sharing. Okay? It's a lesson about sharing. And so here's how it went. Jesus sees this crowd. They're all hungry. And some of them had brought lunches with them. They had the foresight to realize, I'm going to be gone for a while. I'd packed a little lunch. But not everybody did. So what does Jesus do? He grabs this young little lad, walks him up, and says, now everyone, let's be nice like this young man. You know, son, would you share your fish and loaves with me? Sure, Jesus. And this inspires, sort of like that commercial where somebody sees somebody do something good, and then somebody else does something good, and does something good, and does something good. So this is just a lesson about sharing. That's what the story's about. Really? That's what we're going to say, okay? It's not a lesson about sharing. Others have said this was actually a staged miracle. Here's what happened. Jesus sent his disciples out ahead of time, anticipating the crowd. They went to these caves, and these little caves that were off tucked in the hills. They actually had a cache of food back there. They stuck this stuff away, and then, you know, at the right time, boom, curtain comes up. Hey, lunch! You know, really, really. That's good. That's creative. That's creative. Others have taken maybe not so much pains to explain away the miracle as to maybe apply this in ways that really it wasn't intended to apply. To say, well, you know, we're supposed to be this is a welfare strategy for society, something like this. And I'm going, no, that's not the point. Those applications may be in there somewhere, but that's not the point. What is Jesus doing? What is he doing? Jesus is establishing his absolute authority over human need. And he's absolutely establishing his deity and his omnipotence over all things. You could say it something like this. Our compassionate Savior cares deeply for the souls of men, and he uses physical needs to show our profound spiritual emptiness. He's using this physical need to show us our profound spiritual emptiness. This story, we're really not going to be able to complete all of our thoughts this morning on this story, because part of what John does is he introduces us to this, and over the next few chapters, he's going to work out the implications. And as you're preaching through the gospel, and especially John, it's hard not to step on your own feet sometimes, because he keeps coming back to things, and he'll say something, and then later on, he kind of blows it out and develops it and develops it and develops it. So there's so much I want to say about this text this morning, but we're going to have to pause, and you'll have to come back next week as we see Jesus himself explains what he's doing in this story. So let's walk through it. I have four simple headings that I'll give you this morning. And with each one of these, there's a lesson, I believe, to learn with each one of these. And I'll explain that as we go. All right. Number one, we have a complex setting. It's a complex story, and at first glance, if we're not careful students and we don't take a little time to really understand the context and what's going on, it may just seem like a simple little thing. But I want to just take a little bit of time this morning and develop this for you. So let us read John chapter 6, verses 1 through 15, to get the story in our minds, and then we're going to come back and take it apart, okay? John chapter 6 and verse 1. After this, it's an indefinite amount of time. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him, because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing what a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread, so that all these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he knew himself what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in this place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told the disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When they saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who has come into the world." Perceiving then, they were about to come and make him king by force, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. What an interesting story, isn't it? The complex setting. There's so much to the backstory. All of these other gospel accounts, as I mentioned, shed a little bit of light on what was going on in this great Galilean ministry. Jesus had been ministering in the north, in the region of Galilee, for some time now. And in the other gospel accounts, particularly Mark, we learn that Jesus had just sent his disciples out on a preaching adventure, sort of their own little short-term mission trip. And they had gone out and they had come back and they were reporting back to Jesus. And then Jesus learns about the martyrdom of John. And in Matthew and Mark's account, we see that right after that, we have this scene where Jesus pulls away and he withdraws to go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Now, whether there was a time break in there or not, it's hard to say exactly. But Jesus was absolutely beat. Ever had one of those days where you just get to the end of it and you're like, tapping out now? No human interaction from this point forward. And you're just done. You're out. You're out of juice, and it's time to just recharge. I think the gospel writers are saying that this is where Jesus was. And in, he was divine, and he was energized by the Spirit of God, but at the same time, he was a human. He was truly human. The Bible makes it that very clear. And in his humanity, he was worn out. He was just worn out. He had learned about the loss of John the Baptist, someone very dear and close to him, and his disciples urge him, "Teacher, let's just get away for a little bit. You need a break. You've healed everybody in the countryside. You've been teaching nonstop. Let's just draw away for a little bit." You know what happens. Verse 2. So he pulls away in the boat, and a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. This is like the understatement of the century. A large crowd was following him. It'll tell us later that there was 5,000. It's 5,000 men. All right. 5,000 men, meaning likely, we don't know. Who knows? Could have been 20,000 people. All right. A typical NBA arena holds somewhere around 20,000 people. You ever tried to feed that many people? Yeah, that's an ordeal. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. These people, they know what Jesus has done. They've probably got friends and relatives that were healed by Jesus. They're hearing the teachings of Jesus. And they're like, "We just got to be close to this guy. We've got to be close." And Mark's account actually tells us that the group, when they saw him leaving, they said, "We know where he's going. He's going to the other side. We're just going to go meet him there." They ran around the entire Sea of Galilee. They ran around and they met him over there. I mean, they're probably grabbing people in the villages on the way, and they see this looks like a marathon coming through the streets. And they're just going, what are we doing? I don't know, but come on. And there's just this mass of people, and they come around, and Jesus, on his little getaway to relax after getting some bad news, gets greeted by 20 grand, 20,000 people. 20,000 people standing over there saying, welcome, you know, kind of like that surprise party when you didn't want to be surprised, right? Like, oh joy, you know, good to see you. And so Jesus shows up, and there's this mass of people, and get this though, they had gone through some effort to be there, all right? They were curious about Jesus, and they wanted to hear his teaching and wanted to be there, which leads us to this lesson here. Jesus demands not belief, not simply curiosity. You see, what's going to happen later in the story that we'll get into in the future weeks is that Jesus actually ends up offending most of this crowd that had worked so hard to be there and to welcome him and to see him. He ends up offending them. You know how he offends them? He tells them they don't believe. He says, you're just here for the party. You're just looking for a free meal. That's the only reason you're here. That's why you're here. That's all you want. And he rejects them, and he sends them out. Jesus demands belief, not simply curiosity. All the time, you get a chance to talk to people. They may be very curious about Christianity. Tell me more about what you believe. Let's discuss this idea that God created the world. That's very interesting. You know, let's talk about what your religion says about this or that or the other. But you know what? It's not simply curiosity that Jesus wants. He wants belief. That's the whole point of the Gospel of John. John tells us at the end, I've written these things so that you may what? Believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. That's why it's written. And that's why John writes, and that's why Jesus does what he does. So back to the story. Jesus arrives. His adoring fans are there. We're told in Matthew and Mark that he taught them for a long time. He healed their sick. They came out. They got what they wanted. And then he looks out and he says, "This is these people are hungry. They've been with me a long time." So verse 3, Jesus went up on the mountain. And there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. The Passover time. This is an interesting little detail that John throws in for us. You know, John mentions 3 different Passovers, at least, in his account. 3 different Passover events. This is significant. The first time we hit the Passover, you remember that? It was in Jerusalem. He was in Jerusalem for the Passover. And what does he do at that one? He goes and he makes all kinds of friends at the temple with a whip. Remember that story? Yeah. So Passover, national Jewish celebration, sort of like, we don't really have an equivalent, but just imagine 4th of July meets Easter for a Christian, okay? It's like the high point. I know, you're trying to process that. I am too. I don't know what that means. There's this nationalistic zeal, and the Passover was a time to celebrate God delivered the Jews out of the hands of the Egyptians. He killed Egyptians, he saved Jewish people. That it's nationalistic, it's exciting time, and God has judged the enemies of Israel, and the people were enthused about that, and they were so excited, and there was this nationalism that was just so high during this time of Passover. And then at the same time, especially those who were more spiritual among them were celebrating the deliverance of God and the institution and this sacrificial lamb that was brought into play and this substitutionary death and this concept of sacrifice. And there was these things were merging together. All that in the context of the Jews were living in their land, but they weren't governing themselves at this time. The Romans were over them. And in some ways, it was peaceful during this time, but they didn't want to be governed by the Romans. They wanted to govern themselves. So this is the height, all right? You get this time, which is already kind of, everybody's just kind of peaked and ready to, you know, raise a flag and charge the hill during this time of year. Not much unlike our 4th of July, right? You get some folks get pretty fired up about that. And so you got that going on, and then you got this guy that shows up, this charismatic leader that has all the gifts in the world, and he's got a group of 5,000 men following him. And some of them are looking around saying, yeah, it's go time. I know what to do with this. It's time for conquest. it's time to take over. And we'll see later in the story, that's why Jesus draws back and says, not yet, boys, not yet. That's not how we're going to do this. And so the Passover is there, and Jesus comes, and he delivers. And there's so many intricate ties between Passover and the life and ministry of Jesus. And we'll see that a little bit during communion as we celebrate what he did and how he transformed the Passover with the lamb that was slain, anticipates Jesus' death, the Old Testament manna that would come down shortly after that, and how Jesus is the bread of life that comes out of heaven. There's so much going on and so much that ties us into the Old Testament scene. All right, so it's a complex setting, and we see that Jesus demands belief, not simply curiosity. All right, number two, there's a simple test that Jesus offers. A simple test. And John gives us exactly what Jesus is doing. At the end of verse 4, he says, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? And he asks this question to Philip. You know why? Most likely he asked this question to Philip. They're in Philip's old stomping grounds. This is where Philip was from. This is where he was called out of. And he looks around and says, hey, Philip, you know the town pretty well. Where can we get some bread for all these folks? And Philip goes, well, I got some connections, but not that good. You know, and you could just kind of see the hesitation. He says, you know, I don't know that we can pull this off. You guys ever been involved in feeding a mass of people? Some of you have. Some of you have been a part of that. What's that like? It's production, planning, weeks of planning sometimes. I had the privilege when I was in California, I worked with the Shepherds Conference, which was a pastor's conference for that happened every year. And we would have somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 pastors that would converge on the campus. And we provided meals during their stay on our church property. And I wasn't directly involved in the meals process, and I still thank the Lord for that. I was involved in other logistical items, taking care of other things. But there would be over 400 volunteers that would come, and you know what many of them were assigned to? Food. And a week or two before the conference would start, trucks would start showing up, and there would be pallets unloaded and just food everywhere. And this was for 3,000 men. Now, granted, we were feeding them multiple meals, but it was a big deal. It was a big deal. And now Peter looks at Philip and says, can we feed all these folks? 20,000 of them? 15,000 of them? It's astonishing. It's astonishing. But Jesus knows exactly what he's going to do. And he's testing Philip to ask him, is he going to see this through a spiritual set of lenses? Or is he going to see it through a man's set of lenses? How's he going to view this? Well, the disciples, they go 0 for 2. In this, actually. They go 0 for 2. Because after this, Philip says in verse 7, Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them just to get a little. He said, just to get a bite, it would be, if we convert this out, about eight months' salary for an average wage worker. About 8 months of salary is how that works out. He says, this for us to just give them all a bite of food, it would take my life savings plus just to give them a bite. And they wouldn't even be satisfied. He's saying, Jesus, this is not possible. Sorry. So after that, Andrew, verse 8, Andrew steps up, says, I got a plan. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, verse 9, there's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many? Now, he starts out great, right? Starts out great. You know, Jesus, I found a boy here. He's got some food. But I don't think it's going to cut it. You're like, just stop. You know, first part of the sentence, awesome. Second part of the sentence, not so great. And he does a little recon work for Jesus and says, we've surveyed the resources. This is the best we got, man. You know, a little bit of loaves. Fish, don't think it's going to do it. Well, this leads us to a lesson connected with this. Jesus does not need our resources, but he uses them. All right? Remember that. Jesus doesn't need your resources. Jesus doesn't need your awesomeness to change the world. Okay? He doesn't need it. He's awesome of himself. He doesn't need your resources. But he uses our resources. And isn't that encouraging for us? Think about the MO of God, how he's chosen to work through history. Moses, he led the greatest deliverance in world history, leading the children of Israel out of Egypt after 400 years of bondage. You know what Moses did that with? A stick, a walking stick. He had his rod, and that's what Moses had in his hand. Moses, go get Pharaoh. Take your stick. All right. Moses, part the water. Raise your stick, and it'll work. See, God doesn't need our resources, but he uses them. He uses just these small, little, insignificant things. David kills Goliath. Odds didn't seem very fair in that one. He had a little slingshot, a little sling and a little rock, and a well-placed rock on this giant of 9 feet tall, and there he goes. There you go. What was the power in the slingshot in David's skill? No, it was God. God did that. The walls of Jericho, you know the story. They go tumbling down. You can sing the song if you'd like. The walls go down. Why? The people walked around the city. Do you think the people walking around the city, do you think the vibration of the earth caused the walls to fall down as the people marched around the city? I don't think so. What's the point in all those stories? God uses our resources, but he doesn't need them. Jesus could have just as easily not taken this kid's lunch and fed everybody, okay? And by the way, the point's not the kid, all right? The point's the Savior, as one commentator said it. The point's the Lord, not the lad, okay? That's not the point of this story. This kid could have gone away cussing because Jesus took his lunch. We don't know, all right? We have no idea. We just know that Jesus took it and used it, and he, who knows, he may have been really happy that he used it. He may have not been happy. We don't know. That's not the point. Don't accent the things that the Bible doesn't accent. The point is that Jesus uses very ordinary things to accomplish something extraordinary, and that's what he's still doing today. He's using little churches all over the world. He's using believers that are holed up in certain places right now with hardly a Bible fragment to look at. He's using them to change the world. He's growing his underground church in places like Sudan and Iraq and Iran and China and all over. God's using the most ordinary, seemingly insignificant things in people to change the world. He still does it. His MO hasn't changed a bit. Well, he uses this kid's lunch, and there's not much to it, really. Let's keep going. Next, we see the instructive miracle. This miracle is it's designed to meet the need of the hour, for sure. It's also designed to teach the disciples a little lesson here. Look at verse 10. Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now, there was much grass in the place, which, footnote on that, means it would have been the springtime, which squares well with Passover around the March-April season because of the rains. So the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. Jesus comes out, and he takes these little loaves, these little barley loaves, it tells us, barley loaves. Is interesting. That would have been the food of the poor for the day. Imagine, you know, big, nice looking focaccia bread kind of thing. These were little, you wouldn't want to eat them, most likely. Look like little Twinkies without the divine goodness in the middle. All right. Just these little pieces of bread. That's what they were. The fish, these fish were probably not like nice, juicy grouper fillets kind of thing. These fish were little, probably dried or pickled like sardines, basically. So that's what Jesus chooses to multiply out and provide food for everybody. It's an instructive miracle. He didn't come just to fill their bellies. He came to teach them a lesson about who he is and about what their need really is. So he begins to take the bread, and it begins to multiply. Now, this is where, how did it happen? I don't know. You know, did he just pull a piece of the bread off and put it in a basket and it regenerated itself and he kept doing that? Did he break it up into little pieces and then he just had another one in his hand? I don't know. We're not told. We're just told that he multiplied it out and all the people got fed. That's how it happened. The Bible says they sat down, Jesus hands it out, and that's how it went. It's great too. It says, every man had as much as he wanted. They all had as much as they wanted. You see, Jesus does exactly what his disciples said couldn't be done. Exactly what they said couldn't be done. They said it would take all of our resources just to give everybody a bite. And Jesus says, I'm not taking your money. I'm not going to give everybody just a bite. I'm going to give them the lazy man's buffet. They're going to get as much as they can eat. It's a complete reversal. And he's teaching his disciples a lesson in all this. The lesson is simply this. Jesus' ability always exceeds the need. Always exceeds the need. There will never be anything that happens in your life that Jesus' ability and grace doesn't more than give you the resources to walk through it. Don't confuse that with hearing me say life is going to be easy. That's not it. Life is going to be hard sometimes. This creation, this world, as Romans 8 tells us, has been subjected to futility. We feel the effects of the fall. We feel hurt, pain, anger, all those things. But Jesus gives us grace. And his grace is more than sufficient for the day. He'll give it to us. It always exceeds the need. Just like this exceeded the need. Always. So, next. Number four, we have an unrealized revolution. Look at what happens. After they gather the fragments, verse 13, so they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments and 5 barley loaves from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. Why 12? There's a lot of conversation about this. Why 12? Well, you know, could this be a reference to the 12 tribes of Israel? It certainly could. Could it be a reference to other things? Maybe so. I'm open to possibilities on that. I think really what John is communicating, what Jesus was doing, was really a lesson for the disciples, though. It's like, here you boys go. Have a doggy bag to take home. 12 of them go. You know, remember this. Remember this. And I really think that's what the lesson was for the disciples, because this is as much for them as for anybody. Then we come to this unrealized revolution. All right, verse 14. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, this is indeed the prophet who has come into the world. Again, happy, triumphant, good, right? The prophet. This is a reference back to Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verse 15, when Moses said, there's going to come a day when there's a prophet like me that comes and he speaks and you're going to follow him. And then right after that, he warns against these false prophets. He said, there's going to be this guy that's going to come. And they're thinking back saying, the prophet's here. Finally. Finally, the prophet has come. And the prophet had come. He just wasn't going to do it just like they wanted to do it. Okay? The prophet had come. They were right about that. Jesus doesn't rebuke them for that. He just doesn't play along with their plan. He just withdraws. He just slips away. And you can see how this would happen. You get a group. They're hyped up. They're nationalistic. They're ready to go. You got a guy that's been roaming around the countryside and he's healing everybody. And they're thinking, healthcare reform. Think he's got an idea, you know? Food crisis. Well, he's pretty good on that too. He's a good teacher. I bet he could fix the school systems. And they're thinking, you know, this is our guy. This is our guy. And he's pretty good in the Old Testament too. We like him. We like him. We're going to make him king. He's going to be our king. We're going to overthrow the Romans. We're going to finally get our country back. And they're excited. There's genuine enthusiasm around Jesus at this point. But it won't last long. It won't last long, because right after this, he starts talking about, I am the bread come down from heaven and you have to eat of my flesh. Now, you start telling people who grew up in a Jewish culture who had all kinds of things about being unclean and death was unclean, and you start telling them they need to be cannibals, well, that's not going to fly. Jesus, you were doing so good. Just let them put you in office. Do you realize the influence you could have? You know, if you would just accept this role and bite your tongue on the eat me part, like just chill it out just a little bit, chill it out just a little bit, and let's just enjoy this and influence for the glory of God. And he says, no, this isn't how it's going to work. Well, this reminds us of just a simple reality. Jesus is no man's puppet, right? Jesus doesn't operate on command. Jesus doesn't just do things on demand. He's not a vending machine where we just walk up to it, slide some prayers in, and he does what we want him to do. We can't create and invent sort of this office in our own mind of what Jesus is supposed to be and say, there you go, Lord, sit. He says, no. I'm defining this thing. You need to sit back and learn, and you're going to get in with my plan. I'm not hopping into your plan. Got it? And that's exactly what he's doing. Verse 15, perceiving that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. There's an interesting story from church history that really illustrates what they were trying to do with Jesus. When John Calvin was a younger man, he really wanted to go and to study and to just be by himself and write. And Calvin was known to be really an introvert that just wanted to just kind of live a quiet life and write and study and influence in that way. And he goes to he had dealings in Geneva, and this man named William Farrell, who was doing a lot of work in the city to reform the church at the time, he grabs a hold of Calvin and says, you need to be here. And Calvin says, no, I'm going back to Strasbourg. I don't have any business here. This isn't my war. I've got things I want to do. And he lived, he had a life of relative ease and pleasure there. And Farrell said this to him. He says, you have no other excuse for refusing than your professed attachment to your studies. But I warn you, this is good. But I warn you in the name of Almighty God that if you do not share with me in the holy work which I am engaged in, he will not bless your plans, since you consider your rest more important than Jesus Christ. That was Farrell's counsel. And after there was a little bit more exchange that went on with that, and Calvin got scared of Farrell. Calvin's like, well, that guy's connected with God. He may be right. And he went back to Geneva. And Calvin, years later, would write, these words frightened and shook me so much that I gave up the idea of the journey that I had undertaken, as if God had stretched forth his hand from heaven above to stop me. And he says, this guy, he rocked me. I was going this way, and this conversation rocked me, and I went back the other way. And this is exactly what they were trying to do with Jesus, saying, no, Jesus, you gotta be more prominent. You gotta step up. But Jesus isn't a man, and he can't be directed like men can. And he says, I'll do this my way. Well, after this, he moves on, and he talks about this during this Passover season, this bread that's come down from heaven. And he says, this bread has to be broken and it has to be eaten by those who would believe. And he's talking, of course, about his body. And he's talking, of course, about those who would believe in the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Well, this morning we have an opportunity to really celebrate that in really a significant way as we celebrate communion today. And the church has been celebrating communion ever since that last Passover when Jesus took his disciples and he took the bread and he took the cup and he broke it and he took it with them to say, this is my body which was broken for you. And the Lord has given us this gift of the Lord's table or communion. And he gives us this gift because he knows that we're forgetful people. And we need to always have the substitutionary life and death of Jesus Christ and his return put back in front of us. Because we forget. We forget. And we need to constantly live with a gospel focus because we forget that.